Mr. O'Sullivan, Reel 23. So we're talking about the men in the lager. You were saying Tom Tunney went into kind of various moods at times. Did the other, and you talked about your own back in Italy, where was that common amongst the POWs that you would?
Well, what I learned about Tom Tunney is if anybody upset him, he would be upset with that bloke for a day or two. Not so very good, but if anybody upset Tom, they knew about it. Same with George Washington upset Tom, and that was it. That was on there for his Walter job, and we won all things. But George Eugene was a different kettle of fish. He came from London. I don't think he was a real Cockney, but he knew the Cockney line in slang. Now, the postman used to be. He couldn't understand Tom Tunney half the time. So George Eugene, if he was on the stat, we was with this Boston more than most of the blokes. And George said, "Oh, then we're going to do." And George, he would start off with his line in slang like apples and pears, stairs. And he'd be reeling out this sort of round in slang to the Boston, and the Boston would be, "Apples and pears. What's apples and pears? Stairs." And then he would say to me, "Apples and pears? What are they in about? Apples and pears." "George, you say apples and pears are..." Well, I said, "George, you're silly." But George, he'd give him all this, the Cockney rhyming slang, just to get him ruined, because it baffled me sometimes, some of the words George come out with. Because sometimes Georgie Jim would just talk in Woody Cockney for the sake of getting him off.
Was there anybody else who was a Cockney that he could communicate with on his own? So he was just on his own?
He was on his own. But most of us knew that his rhyming slang was rhyming slang, and you only had to really think about it. Apples and pears, stairs. I can't think of those, but suit and everything had a rhyme to it, didn't it, you know, but the old Boston, it used to really get in the room. He couldn't find it in his book at all.
Now, you mentioned Georgie Gent was married. What about the rest of you within the hut?
I would say the only two married men, and I'm not sure that Benny was married. Georgie was definitely married. Whether Benny Lewis was or not, I don't know, but he was. Dick Gunster wasn't. Jim Britton might have been, but I wouldn't have thought so. But Georgie Gent was definitely married, and I say, I don't know about. But Tom Tunney wasn't, Davis wasn't, Alfred Granger and Chairman weren't, Bill Woolley wasn't, and Bill Woolley came from Welland Garden City. He wasn't married. I think if there was any married man, he would be Georgie Gent, and maybe Benny Lewis, I wouldn't be sure.
Now, you were able to communicate with home, and they were able to, you know, write to you and so on. Other POWs have talked about, you know, the so-called Dear John letters and so on. Was any of that going on?
Johnny Alley was married. And Johnny Alley got a Dear John letter. He was the only one in the camp who did. He got a letter one day, and he was back on his bed. He slept below Acres. Acres slept on the top, and Johnny slept below. And Johnny was sat on the bed, and he was just inside the door. And it was a one evening, 6 o'clock time. The postman just brought the first one, and Johnny got letters, and Johnny wrote one. And it was a Dear John letter. His wife was having a baby, and she couldn't work on coming out. And Johnny was upset for a while too. And he said, there's no bloody way you can use me, don't they say that? He said, Johnny was captured I don't know where Johnny was captured, but I don't think he was captured in our end of Africa. I think he was more from the river. So he'd been in the bed quite some time, longer than I had. And yeah, he couldn't really understand the woman, I don't know. But he was really upset with it.
But that was the only one that
was the only deal he was. But I say, I think there was only Johnny Hawley and Georgie Dent, maybe Ben Lewis, who were married. None of the others were married. So there was no chance from Gandhi doing that, was it?
Did people's mood change when they got letters from home, did they?
Yeah, depending on what. I mean, sometimes you got letters from home when there was bad news. You know, would have been killed or... sometimes you got bad news. Well, your granddad's died or something like that. As a rule, it was just piece of writing. And we kept them and we read them time and time and time again. We kept them on the bed. And you never read anybody else's letter.
You mentioned cigarette parcels, Davies parcels.
Yes, was.
But there was nothing, he was the only one who...
Early on, I'll bet he had 3 cigarette parcels before anybody else got them. And I don't think any of them got cigarette parcels before the Red Cross parcels started to turn up. But Davey got these parcels. And in the cigarette parcel there was at least 200 cigarettes. They were specially packed by the tobacconist, the shopkeeper, and they were sent. That's all there would be in them. There'd be no letter in them, just cigarettes, with his name and that on the front. They had special labels for parcels. And instead of him doing the decent thing and handing them, if he'd just handed a cigarette out, But Davey hadn't got a mate in the camp. Nobody wanted to share with Davey.
So who did share with him?
Jim Britton. And Jim Britton detested him.
So he did it reluctantly?
They shared because they had to do it. Somebody had to share with Davey and Jim Britton was he was in most of the time, so he didn't have a chance to make.
What was wrong with Jim Britton then?
He was often laid in bed for days at a time. He was a big strapping Welsh, played rugby. I think he played rugby for Wales at one time, before the war. He was really big blow, but he was often sick.
Did people fall out over with the parcels, with the parcel distributions and so on? Or did people...
With the food parcels? No, because you only had one parcel between two people.
But did the two people fall out?
No, not really. There was always an agreement, same as me and Bill. I didn't smoke. Bill did, so there was no arguing about cigarettes, they were no good to me. So I got the chocolate. It was the same sort of arrangement I've had in Italy. I got the chocolate, he got the... And my chocolate very often went down to Mrs. Price. So there was no real argy-bargy about sharing food.
What about discipline? You mentioned earlier Dickie Dunn was the man.
Well, the discipline was self-imposed. Everybody knew where to get on together. And we knew at 9 o'clock the door was going to be locked. And we were going to be inside for the night. If we were playing cards, there was no point in arguing, because if you got arguing at cards, the game was just packed up and there was nothing. Same with the music. We all tried to suit Tom and Smithy with the music. But Tom found out that if he got a bit too scruffy with us, then that was it. That would bugger thing up, Tom. So he became to get more reasonable, He wasn't so demanding. He couldn't understand why we didn't understand music. He couldn't.
And, you'd settled into this routine, you'd been there the best part of a year now, it's after D-Day. When did the realisation set in that it wasn't going to be over by Christmas, that you were still going to be there for another year?
Well,
into the next year?
I think that a couple of months after D-Day, I think, that when the Germans were held up at Monte Cassino, the British was held up at Monte Cassino, and that, so the only little drawback was to put us down a bit. And he's held up quite some time at Monte Cassino, haven't he? Eventually they went round it, did they? I'm not sure. But then sort of, then little things would, you know, take them around down a bit. But I think we began to realise before it got to Christmas that it wasn't going to be for Christmas.
And can you remember hearing of the German offensive, the Battle of the Bulge? That's what was called the Battle of the Bulge. Did that filter through to you?
Well, we listened to all the English news, and the English give us the...
The Battle of the Bulge, Mr. O'Sullivan, and what you could, how that filtered through into Germany.
The Battle of the Bulge, according to the Germans, was a victory for them. There was only their own, and there was, but we listened to British radio, and we got the, all right, the elders up at the casino, but we felt in our own, we really felt that the war was practically over. And that we were going to be on very soon. But the Germans, some of them, the Burgomaster, the assistant Burgomaster, Ernst, who was the overthrower on the staff side, there were Nazis who really believed in the Nazi party. And they didn't believe that there were still believing that Germany was going to win the war. There was going to be. Because at this time, Fiedler, his name was the assistant burgomaster. He was taking a lot more interest in the German, in the POW line. He was much more in contact with us than he had been.
In what way was he?
He was involved with the stat work directly, and he seemed to want to know if we was getting to know more than he was getting to know, because I think in the village itself a lot of people realised that we were getting news from somewhere.
So even though,
and they wanted to know the news that we were getting to know, I really believe that.
Did Mrs. Price listen with you to the British radio?
She couldn't understand it anyway.
And similarly with the daughters.
No, they just left me to it. So the idea of that was, if I was caught, I was doing it unbeknownst to them.
And did they ask you what the news was?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they wanted to know what.
And you would translate it?
And I would tell them, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and Tom Tunney and Ben Lewis was getting the news, because there was abstaining at night.
And where were they going then?
I was going upstairs to visit the Coleman and his daughter in the maid.
And that was that something that developed? Was that like a D-Day thing that you?
It developed before D-Day. It developed early on when we were able to communicate better to the Germans directly. The Coleman and his daughter and the maid were quite friendly. We didn't see a lot of one hour. They did came into our part of the building. But the three windows in the line were arch shaped at the top, with bars across. But Benny Lewis and Tompkin found out if they laid backwards, they could work their way through the window and up into the windows above, which belonged to the floor line upstairs. And very often at night, they disappeared up there. And they were getting the news up there as well. Something else, again, was something besides that. And then they came, and as I said, when the pastors, when the first time they ever went upstairs, about early in the morning, knock on the window, so we could open the window for them, because we knew what it was, and they handed in some pastries, some pies. So nobody minded them going, because, as I say, they shared with people who needed it, you know, and Alfred Grange, and we didn't need it. Neither did Garbutt, or Rolf. We were getting that sort of thing where it was working. So, and then once the food starting started, they took a lot of the ingredients out of the Jock McRae with Tony's Mooker. Georgie Gent was Benny Lewis's Mooker. So they often took food out of the food parcels, out of the Red Cross parcels, upstairs, in sort of exchange for the fat, because they're much fat in Germany, then any good fat in Germany, not the average householder. So they used to take the butter or margarine, whatever it was, in the food parcel, sometimes the cheese. They were sort of sharing the food parcel with them upstairs, but they were getting it back in food, you know, like the pastries or, because if there was apples, and I suppose that one did the same, she would have fruit in kiln jars, what they'd, you know, in the season they'd be bottled up, and that's what happened with them.
Do you think these German civilians were taking a risk dealing with you?
Oh, they were, yeah, definitely. If they'd have got caught, especially by the burgomaster or the assistant burgomaster, they would have been in trouble.
And what about the coalman himself? Did he know that this was going on?
Oh, definitely. He must have done.
And was he kind of, what were his politics?
His politics was, you've got to look after yourself on this job.
And the woman...
Most of the Germans in the village were Germans, just average German people. Some of them, such as Ernst and the sister, they were party members when they were forced to join the party. You know what I mean? They were genuine party members of the Nazi party. And they believed in the Nazi party. Frau Schnee believed in the Nazi party. And she was English.
So she was a Nazi, even though she was English?
Oh yeah, she was married to in the embassy girl, wasn't she? I mean, the option, isn't she, really? So we would never talk to Frau Schnee. If you saw her in the street, you would never acknowledge her. And she wouldn't try and acknowledge you either, she would just walk past.
Did you notice a change in the attitude of the diehard Nazis the further you got towards the German defeat?
I still thought it was going to win. They were blind. They believed in the Nazi party. I thought Hitler was marvellous.
What did you feel yourselves when you'd seen this jet plane, you'd heard about the various V weapons. What did you think about those things? Because they were quite advanced.
They were quite advanced, but I knew there was a bomb in London with them. We know that because we used to so many V bombs have been shot down and so many V bombs in London. But if you think about it, as we do, because we've nothing else to do but think about it. Them V bombs were no worse than the Blitz, were they? You know, alright, there's some people going and killing them, which is, but they weren't any worse than the Blitz had done, and they weren't any more successful. So, English radio was the same in Germany radio in some respects. They never gave the darkest. They never enlarged on the darkest part of the world, did they? You know, even when we was in a bad position, the English radio made it look as bright as it could. So I mean, we never really got upset about the V-bombs. The one thing we noticed about that plane, it had to go bloody miles to turn around. It was non-maneuverable. It couldn't manoeuvre the same as it had the speed, definitely. Because I mean, it couldn't manoeuvre.
What about the American raids were taking place during the day and the British raids at night? You've mentioned the one incident with the town being hit and all the glass being blown out. I don't want to take us. I know you've got a memory of right towards the end of the war with the Hitler Youth and so on. But were there any incidents before Christmas 1944, more incidents with the Allied air attacks?
One thing, there was so going up, we never was troubled in any other way. That was the only way the river was on, was Lederberg got any bombs.
Mm-hmm. I think you said off the tape that one of Mrs. Price's daughters was involved in somewhere with air raid precautions.
She was, We often used to get an error in warning because the flag was going up, obviously. I mean, you could see him going up. Hundreds of other things. And we often thought, what happens if the flag bumped us? Because we were London, weren't we? But when the sirens went, and this was towards the latter part of the war, when they was used to doing warning in there, India, in the Smeda group, if you hadn't a job, you had to be off the streets. Nearly every woman of 18 or over, or man, had a job to do. It was either fire wardens, work with a fire brigade. And the fire engine was something like you see on the two big pumps. You know, people pumping one side, same as this, our old fire engines used to be like. And Inge was a firewoman. They had no special uniform. All she had was a badge, which said fire, well, whatever Germany's for fire brigade, on a tunic. As soon as the sirens went, if you hadn't a job, you had to be off the streets. If you wasn't off the streets within a certain length of time, of the, say 15 minutes and the policeman called you, they would find you 3 miles there on the spot. But the funny part of it was, we were POWs. There was Georgie Gent, if this happened in the morning, when Georgie Gent and me and Phil Carrick, we just used to walk back to the lager on the street. And if the policeman saw us, he would just sort of, all right, and nobody bothered us. Just walk back to the lager. The men, Frankie Rolfe, there, he worked in a timber yard. They had their own sort of, it was only under a load of timber where he would have gone if there'd been any bombing. For the guard, but they had their own particular arrangements. They didn't make their way back to the lager. But we was on our own, we was in the streets. We never was sleeping in the streets when the sirens went. We just walked back to the lager.
Did you?
It was all clear, we'd walk back.
Still in 1944, were there any memories of the German responses to these attacks? Did you ever see any German aircraft, a bit apart from this jet, trying to deal with them?
Very, very soon. There would be odd ones about, but there was nothing. I mean, there was literally hundreds of American bombers going on, big ones. And I mean, there was that bloody eye up that looked like small Spitfires. There was, you know, there was, the sun was shining. They were there like this. There was flying to Halle, Berlin, Leipzig.
Just on the question of the Germans' attitude to the war at this stage, were there any examples of Germans making fun of their own, of Hitler? Did they ever tell you a joke about Hitler or
Never. Nothing
like that?
Never.
And would you ever try to tell?
No, I would never tell. One thing we avoided, political. We never made Douglas do that. The nearest they ever come to being saying that was when the initial announcement made that he'd been assassinated. There was a lot of relief. But I mean, as soon as I found out that he wasn't, the mood switched back to he's in charge, sort of thing.
And were you ever, you never gloated about the victories then?
Yep. Once. In a cinema.
Ah, well, we'll get to that. That's later on, isn't it?
Well, it's about now, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But we'll do it tomorrow anyway.
So the cinema visits, how did that come about?
It was some sort of a holiday, I don't know what, but the POWs from Smedegård, along with the Sikh camp, we went to the cinema anyway, and a lot of the German civilians thought it was unfair because you had to be a certain age before you could go to a cinema. Inge was 18, she could go to a cinema. travel was 16, and she never got to go to the cinema. And while I was in this cinema, they were showing New Rose. And we watched Baron Munchausen, was it?
Munchausen?
Baron Munchausen was the film. And we watched this fabulous film, and then they had a break. And during the break, they showed a movie of Theodore Wilson and captured troops. And then it showed Hitler. And some black British men started to boo. they stopped the film and cleared us all out. And we never got another chance to go. And I think we were lucky, really, that it didn't take any further action. But
what was the
The trouble was that a lot of the Germans themselves were quite... They would have cheered with us if they did, you know. But it was late on in the war. I mean, late on while we only ever went once, and it was late on in the period of time we were there.
Do you think that was before Christmas 44?
It could have been it was after Christmas 44.
And
it was some special, it was either an Easter or it was some German holiday. And they thought they would give us a treat.
And were the German, who actually decided to give you the treat, who would that be?
Well, the Burgermaster was who allowed it. You know, and
could that have been an attempt to curry favour with you?
Well, very likely, yeah. But the Indians, they were there as well, of course they got turned out as well. And the Indians were twice as smart as we were. They marched up to the cinema. We marched up to the cinema, but the Indians marched and they stopped, and it was like a drill parade then. And after we were kicked out, they took us back to the Indian barracks. And that's the first time in my life I've ever had curry, and the last time I've ever had curry, because they made us a meal. Because they got parcels, but they weren't English. They were English, but the contents were Indian food, and they had curry in it.
So where were they based?
I don't know. They weren't far away, because we walked. We marched to, we marched back to there. But I don't know where they actually were. We never came in contact with them. It was a working party, you know, when I was out at work. So it must have been outside of Swedenborg.
And how many of them were there?
About 15.
And you never found out what they actually did,
Well, they did the work the same as we did, but I don't know where.
And could they speak English?
Oh, yeah. No, there was Indian soldiers attached to the British Army.
Just on this point, just to make it clear, in your lager, hut. Could you describe how far that away was from the village of Bad Schmiedeberg proper?
I think we had to walk a mile and a half from our lager to the village itself, and the stone factory was maybe another mile and a half on the other side of the village. There was all the work for the, especially for the staff. They walked 3 miles to work in the morning.
So there was, and was there anything between the lager and the village? Was there anything else on that road as you were?
No, not at all. There was a bit of a farm, but I think that belonged to the coolman.
And going the other way, what was?
There was nothing beyond our lager. There was green fields beyond our lager, because that night we're in the area, we went out into the field.
And how far was the nearest other villages and towns? What was the nearest village to you?
Well, I was thought the nearest place was Wittenberg. Fletch was about 6 miles away, but it was on the other side of the Elbe.
That was going east.
Was it? Yeah, it would be, yeah.
Now, backtracking slightly, you told me off this tape a story about Mrs. Price and making you a birthday cake.
When I was 21, which was in March 1944. She made me a birthday. Mrs. Price really spoiled me, but she made me a birthday cake. It was about an engine out to Winchester with a cherry, all cherries, in sort of a glaze. It must have been 3 foot, the 18 inches or so, on a big flat tray. And